Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 20th, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And later this half hour, we'll get the latest key state crop condition reports from NASS, as well as the latest agricultural weather from meteorologist Don Day. And in the second part of the show, the farming world, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with Mary Kay Thatcher of the American Farm Bureau Federation. It's all on the Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's how prices settled on this Tuesday afternoon in Kansas City. September wheat, 589.5, down 5.75. December, 606.5, down 5.75. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 577, down 5.25. December, 607, down 4.5. March, 630, down 3.25. September corn, 374, down 7.5. December, 387.5, down 6.5. March, $4, down 6. May, 408.25, down 5.25. July, 415.25, down 4.75. August soybeans, 10.11.75, up 3.75. September, 9.86.75, up a half. November, 9.73, up 1. January, 9.81, up 1. March, 9.85.25, up 1.75. May, 9.87.5, up 3. August soybean meal, 3.01.50, down 3.50. September, 2.91, down 3.70. August soybean oil, 38.40, up 44. September, 38.58, up 44. August live cattle, 93.12.5, unchanged. August feeders, 114.47.5, up 5. And August lean hogs, 80.02.5, down 160. And those are Tuesday's settlements in Chicago and in Kansas City.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says rain totals in some areas may peak out in the 2 to 5 inch range by Saturday, resulting in some local flooding. Most dry pockets in the Midwest will be given enough rain to either improve soil conditions or to help stop any further declines. Crop weather will continue fine for the next couple of weeks. No prevailing high pressure ridge is expected over the next 10 days. Temperatures will be seasonably warm through the end of this week, with upper 70s and 80s in the north and middle 80s to lower 90s in the south. Cooling is expected this weekend with lower humidity and a brief bout of drier weather with highs in the 70s and 80s. And warming will return next week along with returning rainfall.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Boy, good afternoon, Dave. I found a little bit of that pixie dust.
You did indeed, and you brought, what did you call, sprinkle it, I guess?
We sprinkled just a little bit on the bean market and brought it back a little bit.
What was the reason behind the beans coming back?
Well, I think one thing, if we look at number one at the bean oil, we saw strength there, 44 to 45 points higher in the bean oil. You know, we've seen some of the oil seeds in some of the dry areas in China and Russia. And the increased buying of beans by Russia again, and some announcements today of some purchases up by China, and, you know, said that maybe they weren't all given today and there'd be more announcements tomorrow, sort of threw a little bit of enthusiasm into the bean market towards the end of the day, Dave.
Well, certainly China has been buying a lot of bean oil from the United States that they haven't been buying in years and years, all attached to Argentina. And who knows if that will continue or not.
They seem to be sort of in a little grudge match down there. Argentina put some restrictions against Chinese trade and vice versa. Then China come back and put some restrictions on their bean oil. And they seem to just be stubborn little kids and not seem to get over this down there, which is great for our American farmer.
They're certainly at loggerheads, and it doesn't appear it's going to end anytime soon. Corn, however, had a down day today.
You know, one of the news articles that come out on the news wires today was talking about the big good possibility of not renewing the ethanol blending credit and also the tariff that's put on for incoming ethanol. And two or three of the large analysts said that that could have a 25 to 27 cent effect on the price of corn if that went off, as to how the ethanol plants would be, how aggressive they would be in what they were doing. So that, along with the very good weather, the midday forecast continuing to show rain across the Midwest and no real damage in heat until pollination is over here, basically kept the corn under pressure, Dave.
Yeah, we did see that story from the think tank at Iowa State University talking about U.S. ethanol production potentially dropping, not a bunch, really, if the tax incentives were removed. I guess ethanol is far enough along that it can probably stand on its own legs, is their thinking?
Well, I think, you know, number one, as long as we have production of it like that and it can be produced at less than the price of gasoline and blended in and sold at gasoline prices, we would think that it probably should be able to stand on its own.
It does it quite a bit, and then sometimes it doesn't. Let's look at the wheat market. What did you see there today?
Well, you know, very surprisingly, we saw Russia being the one that sold Egypt their wheat in the tender out there today. It was handled by, I think, Cargill and Dreyfus through their offices in Russia, but it was Russian wheat that was used to fill that tender, and I think that was a little bit surprising that there were still that aggressive sellers with the way that they're talking about their crops. So along with that and with the other stocks they have, and as cheap as that sale went to Egypt, why that and the good weather and the good crop that we are seeing being harvested in the U.S. Kept a little pressure on the wheat market.
What do you make of that Russian sale? Those two things that you just talked about don't go together very well.
Well, you know, there's an awful lot of wheat in storage over there. They need some cash flow, and I think they're willing to sell what they have, hoping on a better harvest for next year. We'll look if there is any restrictions put on by the Russian government for it to be down the road 2 to 3 months and get a better handle on how their harvest actually finishes up.
How's basis been doing in your neck of the woods these days?
You know, for good corn, we're hearing premiums up to a dime on that. And for bad corn, we're hearing increased discounts, basically doubling after a damage gets over 5% and test weight gets under 52. So it's a very variable depending on the quality of the grain out there right now.
Which begs the question, how much good corn do you think is still in farmers' hands?
Not as much as the whole country would like it to be, especially the farmers themselves. I think that there's the majority, or probably over 40% of the corn out there, has some quality problems, Dave.
So do you think then for the Gulf to meet the shipping requirements, and it's over 300 million metric tons as of last week, that those shipments might end up getting delayed while we're waiting for new crop corn to come off in the down in the deep Gulf?
Well, I think there could be very easily be some premiums paid for good quality early corn that comes out of the far south to blend some of this, Dave. I think that's a very good possibility. It's going to be a two-tier system. It's going to be quality is one price and non-quality is another.
Some of this bad corn in farmers' hands, when will it go to the market?
Well, it should have went yesterday, and if it's in bad shape, it should go tomorrow. But I'm guessing they're going to probably sit on it for another couple of weeks.
Take a look at the outside markets with you for a couple of minutes. The oil had a nice buck rally today.
Oil turned around, popped back up, buoyed along with the idea that the crude oil, the bean oil, and the palm oil all saw a little bit of a rally there and a little bit of energy rally. The dollar mildly higher on the day, and of course the Dow Jones making a nice worked its way back up over 10,000. It's at 10,150 here now, up 90 ticks as we go. So the stock market seen a little bit of recovery after the sell-off from Goldman Sachs' numbers.
Late last week, the strategy was, because everybody was thinking, well, maybe there is a ridge this week, a weather ridge. Everybody and his brother were buying cheap calls. Now they're holding those cheap calls. What do they do with them?
Well, I guess he's them for wallpaper, but I don't think that the cheap calls are probably the thing as of quite yet. I think we'll see a little bit farther push down in the corn. The beans might be able to hold their own here, Dave, but I think the corn probably has 7 to 10 cents more to work on down here before it'll stabilize.
Do you think that the high is in for corn?
You know, I mean, I would have to say that it feels that way as we speak right now. There's a long time till harvest, and a lot of things can happen politically, weather-wise, as far as China and Russia, let alone the U.S. and how we finish things out. But it does look like this corn crop is coming along, and it's going to looks like it's going to be a very good crop, at least in our area, and many areas around out there. So I have trouble thinking that corn is going to make a resurgent move here before harvest.
The number of unknowns are far less than the beans right now.
Oh, yes. I mean, the beans, of course, the next 6 weeks are very, very important to them. Our later beans did catch up quite a bit in this last week. They had been sitting still in their growth pace, but they did pick up quite a bit. Talked to two or three seed salesmen today. They've been out calling on people, and they thought the beans had improved more than corn had over the last week, it's at least in from southern to central Indiana.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Wayne Nelson, and he is with L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Yesterday afternoon, after the closing bell, NASS issued its latest crop report for the week ending July 18th. 30% of the corn crop is silking versus 38% a week ago. 4% of the corn crop is in dough stage. Crop conditions for corn, 2% rated very poor, 7% poor, 19% fair, 71% good to excellent versus 73% a week ago. 41% of the soybean crop is blooming versus 40% last week. 8% of the soybean crop is setting pods. That's the same as a week ago. Crop conditions for soybeans, 2% is rated very poor, 7% poor, 24% fair, and 67% good to excellent versus 65% last week. Here are the key NASS state reports.
This is Mark Schleusener with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending July 18th. Hot weather continued across all of Illinois last week, while rainfall totals were mixed around the state. Overall, temperatures averaged 78.9 degrees, which was 2.4 degrees above normal. Rainfall averaged 0.69 inches, just 1/100th of an inch below normal. The average growing degree days since May 1st reached 1,668, or 9% above average. Crop progress for corn is ahead of average and well ahead of last year's pace. Corn silking reached 89% complete compared to 24% last year and 65% for the five-year average. 18% of the crop has reached the dough stage compared to 10% normally at this time. 67% of the crop was rated as good or excellent, up slightly from last week. For soybeans, 64% of the crop is blooming compared to 22% 1 year ago and 56% normally. 15% of the crop is setting pods compared to 14% for the five-year averaged. Soybean condition also improved slightly from last week. 64% of the crop is now rated in good or excellent condition. Wheat harvest is essentially finished, and oats harvest reached 39% complete, which is 15 points ahead of normal. This has been Mark Schleusener with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAF's Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending July 18, 2010. Crop development continued ahead of the five-year average pace despite a stormy week. On Wednesday, powerful thunderstorms moved across the southern and central Minnesota, with reports of localized hail, damaging winds, and isolated tornadoes. However, the heaviest rains were reported mostly in the northern and eastern sections of the state. More storms struck Saturday evening as hot, humid air gave way to severe thunderstorms, accompanied by strong winds, localized hail, and reports of tornadoes across the northern portions of the Twin Cities. Small grains ripening advanced at a rapid pace. 67% of the spring wheat was ripening compared to 13% last year and 34% for the five-year average. 69% of the barley was ripening, 54 percentage points ahead of last year and 28 points ahead of the average. 80% of the oats were ripening compared to 39% last year and 57% for the average. 2% of the barley and 6% of the oats were harvested, respectively. Corn silking jumped 45 percentage points from last week to 59%, 25 points ahead of the average. Average corn height was 73 inches. 63% of the soybeans were blooming, while 7% were setting pods. Soybean height was 22 inches. Producers continued to scout for soybean aphids. Crop conditions generally improved from last week. Corn condition was rated with 55% good and 35% excellent, while soybean conditions were rated with 59% good and 25% excellent. Spring wheat condition was rated with 56% good and 32% excellent. That's the weekly crop weather report for the week ending July 18, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln. Wheat harvest was in full swing in the southwestern counties and had begun in the panhandle. The heat and humidity are aiding crop development, but are placing stress on livestock in confined areas. Irrigation has started where necessary. Irrigated corn conditions rated 82% good or excellent, while dry land corn rated 85% good or excellent, both near year-ago levels. Corn silked was at 60% ahead of last year and average. Corn in the dough stage was at 2%. Soybeans blooming were 51% complete, and soybean setting pods were at 7%. Wheat harvest was 44% complete, behind last year's 52 and 70 average. Sorghum headed was at 5%. Dry beans blooming was at 11%, while the first fields were setting pods. Oat harvest is 43% complete, ahead of last year's 28, but behind the 45 average. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Joining us now with energy analysis is Mike Barinski of Louis Dreyfus Commodities Biofuels in Kansas City. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon.
Well, it looks like the crude oil futures had a nice little pop today.
Yeah, they've had a pretty good run here after, you know, last week when it was a little bit moving the other way. Haven't had quite the gasoline demand that we've been hoping for in the summer. The EIA data that was published last Wednesday, which obviously includes the July 4th weekend, wasn't as stellar as was hopeful for. So, you know, gasoline and energy certainly has a limited upside here.
Probably get another drawdown tomorrow, do you think?
I think so. I think, you know, seasonally we should be getting another drawdown here. You know, the data bounces around from week to week so much, but I think, yeah, we should be due for a little bit of a drawback here.
What do you make of the news that we got earlier this week from the International Energy Agency that now says that China is the world's largest energy consumer and not the U.S.?
You know, I think it just opens up the door for a lot more opportunity. The U.S. is just starting to come into its own as far as an exporter of ethanol. And I think going forward and in the future, China as well as mostly Asia is going to be a big home for U.S. ethanol exports.
Interesting that after the IEA's calculations came out, China said the numbers are unreliable. I think they're probably a little bit sensitive to energy usage and don't want to be tagged as a developed nation, probably.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They certainly don't want to push it so much that they're, you know, forcing themselves and, you know, to pay off for energy. You know, the last thing they want is to have a story get out and end up, you know, sort of killing their own internal economy that way.
What do ethanol margins look like these days?
You know, they're steadily over variable and fixed costs at most plants. I'd say, you know, the majority, if not all, your plants in the country today should be making money. That being said, they're not necessarily stellar either. You know, we're hanging sort of around you know, a level where plants may not shut down, but they could consider slowing down if these levels sustain here. As well, if you look out into the forward curve, you know, the job of the forward curve has always been to sort of disincentivize build out, and that's what it is right now. So, you know, even if we hold the situation and we kind of stay at margins like this, there's not going to be any more future build out. There's just no incentive to bring an ethanol plant on right now unless it was already being built.
We have about 20 or 30 seconds left. What should we be keeping an eye on the balance of the week in energy?
I think in energy, you should definitely be keeping an eye on the numbers coming out tomorrow. As far as ethanol goes, I think there's a major development going on in Washington right now as far as the extension of the blending credit. Both groups, the Growth Energy and the RFA, have come out with sort of differing opinions on what they would like for the near-term future. I think that's going to be a major point here for ethanol for the next year.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike Marinsky of Louis Dreyfus Commodities Biofuels in Kansas City. In 2 minutes, Todd Gleason will be by with a look at the agricultural weather. Oh, actually, I'll do it, I think, this week. Thanks. It's National Lollipop Day. Racine, Wisconsin claims that it was the first to automate lollipop production, inventing a machine in 1908 to put hard candy on a stick. The machine could make 40 suckers a minute. On this day in agricultural history in 1801, Elisha Brown Jr. pressed a 1,235-pound cheese ball on his farm. He then loaded it onto a horse-drawn wagon and presented it to President Thomas Jefferson at the White House. The giant cheese arrived on New Year's Day in 1802. It measured more than 4 feet in diameter and about 17 inches in height. And it was emblazoned with Jefferson's favorite motto, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." In 1836, Sir Thomas Clifford Allbutt was born, an English physician. He invented the short 6-inch clinical thermometer. Before this, a foot-long thermometer was used that took 20 minutes to determine a patient's temperature. And in 1851, the first cheese factory in the U.S. to make cheese from scratch was started in Rome, New York by Jesse Williams. He had his own dairy herd, and he purchased more milk from other local farmers to make his cheese. By combining the milk and making large cheeses, he could produce cheese with uniform taste and texture. Before that, companies would buy small batches of homemade cheese curd from local farmers to make into cheese. Each batch of curds producing cheese with wide differences in taste and texture from one another. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Don Day of Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Good afternoon, Don.
Good afternoon.
Looks to me, as I look at these maps, that just perhaps around where I live in places north, northern Illinois, northern Ohio, may be getting quite a bit of rain.
Yeah, it really looks like it. It's going to be an active thunderstorm pattern today and into tomorrow across many areas in the Midwest. And the areas you mentioned, Iowa, northern Missouri, central and northern Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, southern Michigan, there's going to be an area of showers and thunderstorms that for the next couple of days will form. They'll be fairly slow moving, and they're going to bring, in some areas, some heavy rainfall. I could easily see 2 to 3 inches of rain or more in some areas. I think most areas are looking at least a half inch to an inch and a half of rain. So prospects for wet weather is good. And in areas that don't see the heavier precipitation, at least light to moderate rainfall will fall elsewhere across the Corn Belt.
So after this wave of storms moves through, will there be any areas in the Corn Belt that are soil deficient for moisture?
Doesn't look like it. As we look ahead into this weekend and into next week, we're going to see a pattern similar to what we have now, to where there's going to be small little weather disturbances coming out of the plain states, tapping into some subtropical moisture out of the Gulf and out of the southern plains, and basically putting us in a position of near to maybe slightly above normal temperatures and frequent chances for more shower and thunderstorm activity. If anything, there might be areas, especially in the northern and western areas, that may be a little too wet over the next week or so.
So I would think that with all that rain coming through, that temperatures would be moderate.
They will be moderate. I think it is going to get a little hotter and a little muggy. Nothing, though, extraordinary in terms of temperatures. But we have been a little below normal or right at normal temperature-wise. Do expect them to get a little bit warmer over the next 10 days.
I want to turn my attention to the plains because I'm hearing reports of cattle dying across parts of Kansas. Is that going to continue, the heat there?
Well, it has certainly been hot there, and they have started the week in the upper 90s and lower 100s. They're going to stay hot. Now, they're going to get some relief from some shower and thunderstorm activity later this week and weekend that will cool them off a little bit. But if there's an area that we could highlight that is real hot and dry, it would be some of those southern plains, Oklahoma, Texas, and portions of Kansas and eastern New Mexico. That's one part of the nation that is really trended hot and dry this summer, and that trend looks to be continuing. It's not a very large area, but it's certainly an area that's been going through a rain deficit, and that looks like it will continue, except for Kansas. I think we'll get a little help as well as some areas of Oklahoma. Texas, on the other hand, will stay hot and dry.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
That's Don Day of Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And you've been listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, and online at willag.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey. Thank you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation and located in Washington, D.C. Ms. Thatcher, thank you so much for being on the program. Farm Bill is, well, beginning to heat up despite the fact that it will be 2012 when Congress really probably gets around to trying to put it into place. What are the primary policy functions at AFBF, the American Farm Bureau Federation, that you're following at this point?
Well, certainly the budget is going to dictate largely our next farm bill, and that's why Colin Peterson has thought maybe it's good to start early. I think whether you believe you're going to have a Democratic-controlled House and Senate when you come back after November, or if the House might flip, that regardless, you're going to have people who are interested in this budget deficit finally. And if that's the case, you're probably going to have a budget reconciliation bill early in 2011 where they would come to the committees and say, cut 5% of your budget or 8%, 10%, who knows what the right percentage is. But certainly agriculture won't be exempt from them. So we probably will have to start in 2011 because going in and trying to cut that much money out of the budget in 2011 and thinking you're not going to have to reopen the farm bill to do it is crazy. And the worst thing would be to rewrite it once in 2011 and rewrite it once in 2012. But depending on how much money we have is going to say a lot about what kind of farm policy we can afford in the future.
Can you divide up the farm policy for me? Because this farm bill takes up so much more than just that's related directly to the land. And maybe, I don't know whether you have the percentages, but give me an idea of where the budget splits out on all the types of things that operate USDA.
Well, we are now exceeding 70% of the USDA budget that is spent for nutrition programs. That's food stamps, women, infant, and children, school breakfast, school lunch, those types of programs, 70 cents out of every dollar. Then you've got the rest of the programs, be it farm programs, crop insurance, conservation, research, energy, credit, that take up the other 30%. So when you really look at the farm bill and the large pots of money, you obviously don't have a bunch of money in the loan rate target price category, because with prices, it doesn't look like we're going to trigger those for a few years. So if you're looking for big pots of money in which to fundamentally change current farm policy, you have to look at the direct payments or at crop insurance or at conservation. And much of conservation is kind of tough to look at because, you know, off the cuff, I'm going to tell you probably more than half of the budget is for the Conservation Reserve Program. And we and everyone else have argued long and hard that once you have a 10-year contract with farmers for CRP, you don't break that contract. So those are the three pots of money that people will be looking at if they indeed wanted to fundamentally change the farm bill.
Well, it seems that the administration is, while they said they weren't really going to do much with the farm bill, at least at one point last week or the week and a half ago, they turned around and already have started to discuss revamping the farm bill in unique and different ways and looking at the revenue assurance programs and the insurance programs and finding different ways to fund them. What do you think of that, and what does AFBF have to say about it?
I think they'll be very involved. They said they weren't going to submit a bill on their own, but certainly they would submit ideas and concepts, and I'm sure they will do background information on how is the ACRE program working and how is the SURE program, the disaster program, working, and what could we do to further enhance crop insurance. I'm sure they will have many ideas, but what I think is very clear is that this administration will focus largely on rural development issues. If you listen to Tom Vilsack, either before the House Ag Committee a couple of weeks ago or in all the speeches he gives around the country, he is big on let's look at rural communities and what we can do there, and not real big on let's look at production agriculture. So that will be something. But again, you know, whether it's this administration or any other administration, they can make all the recommendations they want to the Hill, but it's the Senate and House Ag Committees that actually draft the bill. So it's sort of like the budget that comes up every year. You may not like what this administration or some other administration has sent, but for all intents and purposes, it's somewhat dead on arrival, and it's the Hill that actually writes the bill.
Well, let's take up some individual things that our farm listeners will be very interested in. AFBF have a position on direct payments?
Well, right now, our position is that we largely like the farm bill that's in place. We think it's working pretty darn well, and I think the question's going to come in on some people believe, and certainly this is true, direct payments are sometimes hard to justify, hard to keep, because people say, why would you pay farmers to not plant or to plant some other crop, et cetera? I think what they failed to take into account is that, you know, we did that somewhat with the direct payments years ago to be able to give farmers flexibility to plant what they wanted to plant versus have to look at the rates from the government. And we also did it because it's very, very compliant with World Trade Organization negotiations. And while that Doha negotiation is dead as a doornail right now, the fact is it will be back. And at some point, we'll have to make cuts in those trade-distorting programs, the things that we classify as amber and blue box. Well, direct payments are green box, and they won't have to be cut to meet international obligations for a long time. So there are people out there who don't like direct payments who are working diligently to try to get rid of them, and they haven't really decided. Do you go to an acre-type program? Do you go to an expanded crop insurance program? What do you really do with it? We've got our state farm bureaus talking about that in a big way, trying to figure out where they want to go. But as of today, our policy says that we think the current farm bill is working pretty well.
You mentioned acre. Take that up. Do you think that that's looks like it's going to work well for producers who have enrolled in it? And they're, I think, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was about 13% to 15% in the Midwest or the Corn Belt that enrolled in that program.
Right. Not a real high percentage of folks that went in. I suspect that after they saw it work for a year, we'll have a little greater participation this year. Certainly, if you got into it as a wheat producer, you did fairly well. Corn and soybeans probably would have done pretty well this year, too. Doesn't really work for cotton and rice. I think the question with acre is, unless the participation rate really jumps, that people either say, it's not worth it, let's get rid of it, or they'll say, let's expand it. And instead of going from a trigger where it gets triggered at a statewide level, maybe we can trigger it at a countywide level or a regional level to make it closer to home. So I suspect it won't live as is, but it could be amended if people decide they want to put additional funding into it.
Universities or land grants have been big supporters of the program, thinking that it works fairly well to help farmers out in their in leveling their revenue when they need it. I was a bit surprised, I guess, personally, that last week, I think it was the Iowa Farm Bureau that came out and said, this is not a program we like or want.
Well, and that's what they're for their discussion for the next time. I think, you know, you have to figure out, do you want to be covered at kind of a whole farm level, or is it important to you, for example, with crop insurance, to be able to insure just your corn acres or just your bean acres? And the same kinds of arguments are going to occur in the crop insurance program in the next farm bill. People are going to say, can we afford to go to a whole farm revenue program? And you'll find many people on the Hill that'll say, you know, we should just be out there for producers for real disasters. And, okay, so if you suffer a winter wheat total loss, but you have bumper crops and soybeans, then should we really be coming in with government help? And there's certainly many, many ways to look at that. But those are the kinds of, you know, 20,000-foot philosophical discussions that will obviously go on between now and whenever we finish this next farm bill.
All right, next topic. Let's take up some of the other things that might be of interest to WTO and the farm bill. For instance, Brazil continues to win cases against cotton in the WTO. That's one that the WTO, or the World Trade Organization, says does not fit. Can you explain how that works, or why it is the case, and what implications that might have as the farm bill debate ensues in the coming months?
Well, the Brazilian took a case against us in the WTO, saying that our cotton subsidies exceeded what we were allowed under current negotiations. And through a couple of years of deliberations now, they did indeed finally win, and they agreed that they understood that this wasn't something the administration could overturn and could fix to make us in compliance, and that it was going to have to wait till the next farm bill. And so until then, we're paying the Brazilians about $150 million a year, presumably through 2012. But, you know, the difficult thing is that the Brazilians, in essence, will have a seat at the table when we're writing the next farm bill, because they found us to be out of compliance, or they went to the WTO and they found us. So there will have to be some changes, both in the cotton program and probably the GSM 102. It's an export credit type program, in order to bring us back into compliance in the next farm bill.
Yeah, is $150 million enough of an incentive to make the Senate and the House set up and pay attention to it?
Well, yes, because really this, quote, deal between the Brazilians and the U.S. was only cut until that point in time, because they understood, you know, they had to wait. But beyond that, they would come back if we didn't fulfill what we said we would do in these negotiations. They'll come back and take us to the WTO again, and we'll have another litigation on our docket. So we've got to be able to do something. And the other thing is they have the ability to come back and retaliate against us. And what they do is they don't retaliate just against cotton. They retaliate against other agricultural products. They retaliate against small business. They took on some of our intellectual property rights. So there is plenty of effort and plenty of kind of spreading the pain across the U.S., I think, probably for them to make their point.
So a foregone conclusion, you think, at this point that those programs will be changed or eliminated then?
Well, I don't think they'll be eliminated. It's a little questionable yet what you do to the GSM 102 program to make it completely legal. But I think without a doubt, you're going to have to at least reduce both of the programs, the benefits of both of those programs.
What does GSM 102 do?
It provides export credits so that if we're competing with some other country to send an export to China or somewhere in Asia, anywhere, we can provide a little bit of credit to make our product more competitive with another country's. And other countries also use those. Mostly, to tell you the truth, export credits are used by the Europeans and by the U.S. But it's in order to help us be more competitive.
Is it a line of credit that the country gets to use, or is it actually money that gets put into the
It's actually a low-interest type of a loan.
All right. Next topic. Let's move on to Animal ID. National Animal ID has been a big topic and remains a big topic. It's controversial depending on which side of the fence I suppose you stand on. Tell me about the program itself, what it's supposed to do, and then maybe some of the controversy that surrounds it, please.
Well, the thought was that Animal ID would allow us to trace back animal health issues in a very timely manner. If you got foot and mouth disease or you got swine flu or some of those things, that it would be a quicker trace back and that we wouldn't have to do as much really looking for these animals. And, you know, this is really a sort of a sector by sector initiative because if you look at the swine industry, if you look at the sheep industry, the dairy industry, those folks already have those animals. Well, the poultry industry and the swine industry, they don't really have to tag each animal individually. They just have to keep them in lots and move them by lots. And, you know, maybe there's one tag for 100 hogs. So it's not hard to do. They're already in a barn. It's not expensive, et cetera. The problem comes in when you go to beef cattle because we raise beef cattle oftentimes out in pastures. You get out in the West, you may not see that cow for several months. And to individually tag each animal, the cost is about $6 a tag. It runs up and is pretty expensive pretty quickly. So I think that finally what this administration has come to is to say, you know, we're not doing very well in moving this animal ID process along. Let's stop where we are. Let's not have us make any more progress at the federal level. And let's turn it over to the states and say, as long as animals just move intra within the state, you can regulate those animals. You can decide what to do. Once they move interstate, they go across state lines, then they're going to have an animal ID. But states ought to figure it out. Well, you know, we think it's great that they understand that what they had wasn't working. I think it's going to be very difficult to make this kind of an approach work, too, because you know, theoretically, you could have states just say, I don't want to play. Well, what are you going to do about that from the federal level?
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at American Farm Bureau Federation in Washington, D.C. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the World Steel Association today says that global crude steel production rose by nearly 28% in the first 6 months of this year, but it continued to slow down in June on a monthly basis as mills worldwide scaled back production. Crude steel output in January to June reached 705.8 million tons this year from a recession-hit 551.9 million tons in 2009. The Agriculture Department is planning a General Conservation Reserve Program sign-up of about 4 million acres in mid-August. FSA Administrator Jonathan Kopis told the National Association of Conservation Districts that contracts on 4.5 million acres will expire this year and that the administration wants the full 32 million acre enrollment provided by Congress in the 2008 Farm Bill. PepsiCo says foreign currency fluctuations hurt its second quarter results, pushing net income down 3%. PepsiCo says it earned $1.6 billion, or 98 cents per share. The company says sales volume of soft drinks in North America continued to be soft. Americans are avoiding soft drinks in favor of juices and teas, but soft drink sales in emerging markets rose, as did snacks around the globe. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. This afternoon, we're talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She's the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We had just moved to the topic of animal ID when we last spoke with Ms. Thatcher. And maybe we should make a transition at this point, Ms. Thatcher, to animal welfare. The Humane Society of the United States has been a bane in the animal livestock side of the world for the last couple of years. And I say bane because I think that's a name that the animals, the livestock side, would certainly use with them. Tell me about what's been happening with this group, where they came from, and what the problems they have with the livestock side might be, and how livestock views them.
Certainly, HSUS has made a real upcoming in the world in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think what they recognized is that they had tried for a good long time to pass federal legislation that would affect animal welfare issues, for the most part, not very successfully. And so several years ago, they sort of changed their idea and they said, you know what, why don't we go out to ballot states around the country in about half of our states and do have ballot initiatives that are available to them. And let's go, and we think we'll have more luck convincing voters on a ballot than we will state legislators or certainly federal legislators. And so they've done that fairly successfully in several states. They've been able to go to other states and threaten, hey, you know what, we're coming to your state. We intend to spend $3 or $4 or $5 million to defeat you in a ballot initiative. So instead, why don't you join forces with us and do this via legislation, and we'll save ourselves all time and money and effort, et cetera. We anticipate this will continue to happen. They have worked on things all the way from puppy mill type legislation that they're at in Missouri this year to, of course, banning gestation crates and battery cages and veal tethering, et cetera. So we suspect that this state-by-state initiative will continue until the time that they think they have enough states out there where they can come back to the federal government and make the argument, okay, we got 20 states or 30 states out there with varying degrees of legislation. Now we need to make all those legislation. We need to make it uniform here at the federal level. So we know eventually it'll come back here. For the most part, have we dealt with horse slaughter and federal procurement of meats? Yes, but more of their initiative has been at the state level versus the federal level.
Yeah, so they're working diligently, and I suppose it's an organization that it appears that you have to kind of come to the table with at some point because they're working through the legislative process.
Well, they are, and what they do is they threaten states. They say things like, you know what, we're going to come, we're going to spend $4 million in your state, and if you will help us in legislation, we'll give you 10 years to phase out gestation crates. If you don't and you beat us in legislation, then next year we'll take it to a ballot initiative, and we're only going to give you 3 years to phase it out. So they make producers pretty nervous who know they don't have the amount of money to be able to phase out their current production system in 3 years, and they think, well, maybe negotiating is better than anything else. They also are, unfortunately, kind of good at splitting off industries. You know, they'll get the poultry industry to pull out of an agricultural coalition or the pork industry, et cetera. And once you start, you know, splintering in those agricultural industry groups, then they have you. So they are able to do that. They have a tremendous amount of money. They're quite the money-raising machine. In reality, what they really do is to make people believe that they represent the local dog and cat shelters, when indeed they do not.
Right.
Less than 0.5% of their funding actually goes to helping hands-on animal welfare type issues. Most of it goes into legislative battles and legal battles, et cetera.
Well, I guess in the bottom line, then, it's just the democratic process in order. Whether you like it or don't like it doesn't matter. It's the way it happens, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge threat, though, and it's something I think we're starting to get a handle on. I mean, we're feeling kind of good. You looked at Yellowtail Wine that was going to give a bunch of money to HSUS, and when we went to them and said, do you know what you're doing here? If you want to give money for animal welfare purposes, there are better ways to do it. We had a truck stop that was going to, you know, serve only meat products that were humanely raised. We were able to turn that around. But they have enough money and enough staff. Their staff is about 550 people strong around the country. So lots of people that work only on animal welfare issues. And they have a budget of about $130 million a year. So it's something that we're going to continue to have to work at. But I think we got farmers out there. They're doing YouTube videos. They're speaking at Rotary clubs. They're talking to folks at church. They're getting out the story that HSUS is really another PETA and not something that we should be very trusting of.
Final topic, budget. It's a tight one. We started talking about it, I suppose, up front just a bit when we began this conversation with the Farm Bill. What things are at risk, do you think, under the budget process?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you got to believe virtually everything other than maybe Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense would be at risk for budget cuts. It is so out of line that, you know, you just can't tinker around the edges and expect to make any progress. We're now at, you know, somewhere in the range of about 13-14% of our GDP is tied up in deficit. We got Social Security growing and Medicare and Medicaid. And you know, really, there's probably only about 40% of the budget that you can really do something about. So when you're talking about making cuts, unless you're willing to make those tough decisions on things like Social Security and Medicare, it makes it much more difficult. But I think probably you get people looking at Greece right now saying, you know what happened in Greece could happen here. They let things get out of whack, too much running on autopilot over there. And we need to wake up here and make sure that we're doing something about that deficit. So I think people are already waking up to that. It won't happen this year because it's an election year, and it's going to be a very difficult election year in the country. But I strongly suspect that we will have to do something pretty draconian about the budget come 2011.
Mary Kay Thatcher is the Director of Public Policy at the American Farm Bureau Federation. She's been here with us on the Land Grants, the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.